Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
No one has ever won 5 U.S. Open Golf Championships. Or has there been one? The PGA Championship was played in 1941, and so was the Masters. The Open Championship was canceled for a second straight year, and the USGA decided to cancel the U.S. Open. Instead, they put on a different tournament. The venue was changed, but almost everything else stayed the same. Heck, the winner even got a champion's medal. How controversial is this topic? Well, the tournament has basically been wiped away from the record books. Next, on Sports Forgotten Heroes, we're going to explore this topic as we discuss the 1941 Hail America National Open.
This is Sports Forgotten Heroes, a tribute to the stars who shaped the games we love to watch and the games we love to play. Stars who provided us with many thrills, but when their time was up, they faded away. We'll take a look back at their spectacular careers, their moments of fame, even if it was just for one season or just one game. And now, here's your host, Warren Rogan.
Hello and welcome to Sports Forgotten Heroes, episode number 121, the Hail America National Open. So, can a golf tournament be a forgotten hero? It's an interesting question. In the sense of how I am approaching this topic, the answer, in my humble opinion, is a resounding YES. You see, the U.S. had become engaged in World War II, and the USGA decided it was time to tone everything down and cancel the U.S. Open. No one has an issue with that. However, the head scratcher here is this. While the USGA canceled the tournament, it opted to put on a different tournament called the Hail America National Open. Almost everything about the Hail America mirrored a U.S. Open. There was qualifying. Big names played, such as Hogan and Nelson and Jimmy DeMeritt, even Bobby Jones. The venue was changed from Interlochen in Minnesota to Ridgemore Country Club just outside of Chicago. Now, certainly, Ridgemore did not play as hard as Interlochen. That's really where the differences ended. Oh, the U.S. Open Championship trophy was not awarded, but a medal replicating the medal for winning the U.S. Open was handed out. So while Willie Anderson, Bobby Jones, and Jack Nicklaus have each won the U.S. Open a record 4 times, the question many golf fans have is this. Ben Hogan also won it a record 4 times, 1948, 1950, 1951, and he won it the 4th time in his incredible run in 1953. But should Hogan top the list with 5 U.S. Open victories because he also won the Hail America in 1941? Joining me today on Sports Forgotten Heroes to discuss the Hail America National Open and whether or not it should be counted as a U.S. Open is Peter May, who is covering the 2022 U.S. Open for the New York Times. Peter is also the author of the book, The Open Question. This book explores the topic answers questions and proposes new questions about this forgotten tournament, that I challenge everyone listening today to go ahead and research. You will find so little about it. It's as if the USGA doesn't want you to know anything more about the Hail America National Open. Okay, as always, before we start the show, I want to let you all know that Sports Forgotten Heroes is a proud member of the Sports History Network. This is a conglomerate of many different types of sports history podcasts. Check it out. There's something for everyone at sportshistorynetwork.com. Also, please visit sportsfh.com. Here, I have more information about the forgotten heroes I talk about. Again, that's sportsfh.com. You can also see a calendar of upcoming episodes. And please send me an email and let me know how I'm doing. Suggest a topic for a future podcast or submit a question. Send your email to sportsfh.info@gmail.com. That's sportsfh.info@gmail.com. Hey, don't forget to subscribe to Sports Forgotten Heroes and to give the podcast a like. Follow Sports Forgotten Heroes on Twitter at SportsFHeroes and look for the Sports Forgotten Heroes page on Facebook. As always, thanks for all of your support. Okay, let's get into today's show with my guest, Peter May. And joining me again on Sports Forgotten Heroes, Peter May. Peter, welcome to the podcast.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on it again with you, Warren. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. I enjoyed our discussion about Lloyd Mangrum and really looking forward to this discussion. It's such an interesting topic, the Hail America National Open. So let's start with this. Set it up for us. What was going on at the time and why the USGA decided to cancel the U.S. Open while other sports such as baseball and football kept playing? The Masters was played. The PGA was played. Other PGA events were played. Why did the USGA choose to cancel the 1942 U.S. Open?
Well, yeah, you sort of answered my question there when you touched it, because golf was one of the sports that did continue after Pearl Harbor. But the USGA was sort of acting on historical principle. They had done the same thing in 1917 when the U.S. entered World War One and canceled their events at that point. And I just, in doing the research for this book, I just came across the idea that this, there was never a question that they were not going to cancel these things, that they were going to devote whatever resources they could get from the golf tournaments that they were involved in to the war effort. But they were not going to be holding, they only had four tournaments at the time. Mm-hmm. They were not going to be holding any of their four tournaments. I think they have like 19 now or something.
Yeah, they do have a lot.
Yeah, but they only had four in 1941 and 1942. So they canceled them then, and then they set about trying to help out the war effort in whatever way they could. But you're absolutely right. They were the outliers in that regard in golf in 1942. The Masters held its tournament. It did not hold them in 43, 44, or 45, but it did hold one in 42. The PGA held one in 42. They had like limited tournaments going forward through the war. I think there were only five PGA tournaments in 43. So, I think also the USGA was sort of concerned about the fact that if they held the tournament, what would it look like? It was in June, so that you're talking 6 months down the road. Mm-hmm. How many guys would be able to play? So they were worried about the look, but mostly I think they did it because they had done it in 1917 and they thought it was the right thing to do.
How did the players react? Were they in favor of calling off the tournament?
Well, not really, but the players, you know, they liked the idea of the National Open, but they were playing regularly every week in 1942. What the USGA did, I mean, the USGA had one tournament a year that they held for professionals. So it wasn't a big deal that they called off the Open. And as soon as they called off the Open, they produced this, replacement tournament in Chicago, which offered US Open type money in war bonds and stuff like that. So the players, I don't think, were affected one way or the other by this. They had been playing right through the year on a regular schedule.
Yeah, it was really strange because instead of playing the U.S. Open, a new tournament was created to fill the void, the Hail America Open. And it's just this funny thing. All right, we're not going to call it the U.S. Open. We're going to call it the Hail America Open.
Right.
And, maybe it's because, I don't know. I mean, today you would say, well, you can't maybe get the international players over here, but I don't know if it was as big a deal. And I don't want to minimize the amount of international players that might have played back in 1942, but, there weren't as many that would have that played in the U.S. Open at that time than as there are today. So it's a really strange thing. Where was the U.S. Open supposed to have been played?
The U.S. Open had been awarded to Interlaken Country Club or Golf Club in Southside Minneapolis. And its part in history is that it was the site of the U.S. Open in 1930 when Bobby Jones won his Grand Slam, and it was the third leg of the four that he won. And it was it had gotten great reviews in 1930 for everything, the course, setting up, the press coverage, everything. And it was well prepared to host the 42 Open. Their general manager and tournament people had gone down to Colonial Country Club in Texas, which was the site of the 41 Open, and just to kind of get the, how do you do it and what's good and what's bad, what works, what doesn't work. So they were fully prepared to host it. And the irony is that they, I've done it in January of 1942, they were told, no tournament this year. But they were given a chance to have the tournament once the USGA decided to resume them, and eventually they just decided they didn't want to do it. So they never had another US Open there. They've had other tournaments here, but they've not had a US Open.
Right. So Interlaken never got the US Open back. And I'm guessing that was by their choice, their being Interlaken.
Yes, it was.
So, and just to confirm again, the USGA is the organization that ran the Hail America Open, correct?
They were one of the three sponsors of the tournament. Yes.
So, all right. So where did the Hail America Open get played?
It was played in Chicago at a fairly nondescript golf course called Ridgemore Country Club, which never hosted a USGA event to that point and never has hosted one since, but stepped up in the middle of the war and said, we can do it, mainly because the people that were promoting the Hail America and wanted to play the Hail America were Chicago guys. The USGA briefly, but not really all that seriously, thought about playing the Hail America at Interlaken in 1942. But the people who were behind the scenes of the Hail America who wanted to stage this tournament argued successfully that it should be in Chicago because Chicago was a major, you know, communication center. It was a major transportation center. It would be easier for people to get in and get out of Chicago. Because, again, remember, we're at war now. So a lot of things that you took for granted that in June of 1941 were not going to be available in June of 1942.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how was the tournament organized? Who was eligible to play? And what differences as far as organizing the tournament, were there differences from, say, organizing a U.S. Open?
There were, but there were more similarities than there were differences, I think, which is why to this day, people, you know, especially Ben Hogan, people think that it should have been counted as a real U.S. Open. It was divided into three sections. The USGA ran the tournament according to the way the USGA wanted to run it. The PGA was another sponsor. Their goal was to just supply the manpower. So Fred Corcoran, who was the head of the PGA tournament committee at the time, advised all his pros to play in it and made sure that the week that the Hail America was going to be held, which was the same week as the canceled U.S. Open, was open for the players to play in it. And the Chicago District Golf Association, which was the mover and shaker to get the tournament in Chicago, they were the ones that did the tickets and the logistics and all the stuff that goes on behind the scenes that, you know, it's like the sausage being made, you know, you don't want to know about it, right? But the USGA ran the tournament. They set up qualifying, they set up exemptions, and they sort of ran it like a U.S. Open, which is why some people think that it should have counted as a U.S. Open, because how many tournaments do you have two rounds of qualifying, local and sectional qualifying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
None,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. except the U.S.
Right.
Open. So, so that's what happened, and they had, if I may just digress just for a second, the day they announced this tournament was going to be held, one of the first people who said he would play in it was Bobby Jones, which was a huge boost to the tournament and to the tournament sponsors, because this was 12 years after he retired. And Bobby Jones was immediately given an exemption to play in the tournament. Duh. But Bobby Jones decided he would play the qualifying rounds anyway, because just to get in shape and, you know, clean off the rust and all that stuff. And the amazing thing is that there were two rounds of qualifying, five rounds in total, if I'm not mistaken, over the two rounds. Bobby Jones had the best cumulative score of anybody in the country.
Wow.
And this included a lot of pros who were playing every week and had not been exempted from the tournament. You know, guys like Jim Ferrier and people like that. And they had to qualify, and they did qualify, but nobody beat Bobby Jones's scores over the two qualifying things, which is amazing, because he hadn't played competitively in 12 years.
Right.
And he was 40 years old, and he was going into the Army immediately after the tournament ended. So his mind wasn't fully on golf, and it was an amazing story. And people thought that that might make him a factor in the tournament. He wasn't, but he lent his name and his prestige to the tournament, and that was a big thing, because they raised a lot of money for the war effort.
So Jones winds up playing. What about other well-known golfers of the day? You know, Hogan, Nelson, Snead, Lloyd Mangrum, Craig Wood. Did any of the well-known golfers from that time period skip the Hail America?
Yes. The field was pretty strong. The only major player that didn't go in was Snead. Because he had just been inducted into the Navy, or joined the Navy. I guess you joined the Navy, don't you? So he had just gone into the Navy. The month before the Hail America, they had the 1942 PGA in New Jersey, and Snead had won that tournament. Back then it was match play. I think he beat Joe Terniza, but he was going into the Navy. But I think from the research I did, it was pretty iffy as to whether Snead could have gotten a service pass to go play in the Hail America. I think he could have. I think everybody would have agreed that he would have been more useful to the war effort, raising money playing golf than going to Norfolk, Virginia, and hoisting cables or whatever we were doing down there. So, but he did not play. But the top level players did play. And the thing you have to realize back then, Warren, is that it was a very, very top heavy tour in terms of winners. It's not like it is today, where if a guy wins twice, you think it's like the greatest thing in the world. I mean, I think there were 15 tournaments prior to the Hail America in 1942. As I said, they played a regular schedule in 1942. Mm-hmm. And there were 15 tournaments. And I think Hogan, Snead, Nelson, and Mangrum won 11 of them. So, and Hogan, Mangrum, and Nelson were all in the tournament, as was Craig Wood. You mentioned him, the defending champion. There were a couple of guys, I like to say now, they were the Webb Simpsons of the time, that didn't play. But the top-level players who more often than not won tournaments were the guys that showed up, with the exception of Sam Snead.
So if all these guys, with the exception of Snead, still came out to play, again, I have to ask, what was the point in canceling the U.S. Open? It's hard to register.
I know. I mean, I think one of the people who was pretty upset about that was Gene Sarazen, who had won a couple of U.S. Opens, but he was no longer really a factor. He was more of a player in the 20s and the 30s, but he was very, very opposed to the USGA canceling the Open. He couldn't figure out why they did it. You're going to play this tournament anyway. What's the difference? And, but I think it just goes back to the organization's belief that, in fact, they used the phrase hollow when they canceled the tournament, because they thought that the winner might in some way be besmirched by a lack of competition or inferior playing conditions or whatever it was. They just didn't want to be there during the war. And the thing is, nobody worried about it in 43 or 44 or 45. But in 42, I think there were enough tournaments there that it could have conceivably had it and then said, okay, we're done. But they didn't. So we're left with the Hail America, which was in and of itself a very competitive golf tournament with all the big Jimmy DeMeritt. I forgot to mention him. He was there too. He almost won the thing. Mm-hmm. So it was a pretty good field for the war.
Yeah. So we're going to get to the tournament now, and we're going to talk about this tournament because it is so darned interesting. It was supposed to have been played. Well, the U.S. Open was supposed to have been played at Interlaken, as we talked about, and instead they canceled the tournament and they staged the Hail America at Ridgemoor in Chicago. So how challenging a course was Ridgemoor? How did it compare to courses that had previously hosted a U.S. Open championship during that time period?
It wasn't a USGA Open championship course. I don't think anybody would deny that. They did their best. One of the reasons they held the tournament there, as I mentioned earlier, was because of the centrality of Chicago. Ridgemoor jumped up and said they'd do it. They had a couple of things going for them. They had public transportation out to the course, which meant a lot for the spectators. so that they could get out there. And it was also a fenced-in property so that they couldn't have, you know, gate crashers and stuff like that. But it wasn't a USGA, you know, it wasn't Medina or Olympia Fields or a number of courses in the Chicago area, which have hosted US Opens. It wasn't that. But they did their best. And the problem was, is that they didn't have the necessary, I don't want to say equipment and stuff like that. Because remember, pretty much everything that you needed to do to improve a golf course would probably be sent right to the war office instead. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, material, machinery, all that stuff. So they did what they could. They did the best they could. For 2 days, the course was just absolutely hammered by the mm-hmm. pros. Then the rain came, and instead of making it softer and easier, it made it harder for them. And at the end of the day, this is what I tell people when they say, well, should it count as a U.S. Open? I mean, that's not for me to decide. But at the end of the day, it produced a legitimate champion in Ben Hogan. And I don't know how you can debate that. I mean, he won the tournament. He won it over some good players. And whether it's a U.S. Open or not, I think the fallback is just the course. It just wasn't, you know, it wasn't Oakland. It wasn't any of the tough courses that the guys were used to playing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the scores reflected that. Hogan won with, I believe it was 17 under par, 271, which included a 62 in the second round. So I think that's, you know, that's the fallback. They're never going to change it. And I think they're going to say, well, it wasn't really a U.S. Open course.
Yeah, I mean, and you talk about Hogan's 10 under 62 in the second round. What can you tell us about that round and how it compares to other low and record-breaking rounds in USGA history?
Well, I can start by saying no one has ever shot a 62 in a U.S. Open. There's only been one 62 in any of the four major tournaments, and that was by the immortal Brandon Grace. But that round, Hogan was very disappointed after his opening round. He shot even par 72, which was way down the leaderboard. The leaders had both the two leaders had shot 65s, and it was way down the leaderboard. He was very upset. When I did an interview with the Golf Channel for this book, they asked me, "What did I learn about Ben Hogan?" And I said, "Well, I learned one thing. He whiffed a shot on the first round." And he actually did. He was on the 17th hole. He had a bad drive. He tried to kind of punch it out into the fairway left-handed, and he whiffed on the shot. He took a six.
Wow.
And which was a double bogey, and finished with an even par 72. So he was not happy. And he came back the next day, 2 hours before his tee time, big surprise, right? And he started a birdie eagle. And he ended up with eight birdies, an eagle, and the 10 under par 62,
wow.
Which, believe it or not, was still not enough to give him the second round lead. But that was quite a round. Nobody, his playing partners at the were, I think, Tommy Armour and Jock Hutchison. They both were like marveled at just the precision that he had on that day. I mean, everything was working for him.
What did he have to say about that round? And you mentioned, you know, his playing partners from the day. What did his peers think about that round?
Well, Hogan himself, you know, it's funny when you read the coverage of the tournament, it's not like it is now. You know, they didn't bring the guys into the press room, talk about the round and go over the shots and stuff like that. And the only meaningful quote that I could ever find from Hogan after that round was, well, if I shoot 62 the next 2 days, maybe I'll end up in the money. You know, that was
vintage Hogan.
Yeah. That's vintage Ben. That's like his Jay Leno moment. Right. And so that's about all I could find. He did talk to Grantland Rice, I believe it was, after the round. And he, again, this is typical Hogan. He shot a 62. He bemoaned the fact that he missed two putts that inside of 10 feet, which would have given him a 60. And he putted very well in that round. And as you know about Hogan, putting was never one of his favorite things.
He always said that it even shouldn't be a part of the game.
Yeah, he never practiced it. He always practiced hitting his irons and his woods. He rarely practiced his putting, and he wasn't crazy about it. But he putted extremely well on this day. But when he got in, he said, I missed two putts. I should have shot a 60. So there you go. But it remains. I mean, it's he had shot a 62. I think it was the year before in a tournament, but. There hadn't been many 62s on what was that, a very fledgling PGA tour.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the USGA runs, I guess, the playing side, the course side of this tournament.
Right.
Ben goes out and he shoots a 10 under 62. Why do you suppose this round gets such little recognition when talking about USGA events? Heck, it's barely a footnote.
That's why I wrote the book. you're absolutely right. I mean, the tournament itself, it got mentioned very briefly in the USGA record books for a few years, and then it got, like the Trotsky years in Russia, just got erased, and no reference to them. And the same thing happened with the 62, and I explained this in the book. That's how I got interested in this tournament. I had not been aware of it until Dan Jenkins, who of course was
Ben's friend,
one of the great golf writers and a very big Hogan guy, had followed. I think it was Justin Thomas or something was shooting six. Looking like he was going to shoot a 63. I think it was at Aaron Hills. He didn't, but Hogan said, you might think that's the record, but the real record is 62 that Hogan's shot in the 1942 Open. And he thinks it's the record, and so do I. And it's good enough for him. It's good enough for me. And I said, what are you talking about? I don't know about the 62. I've never heard of a 62. And that was always Johnny Miller, 63. So I did some research on it. And the funny thing is that a lot of people who I consider to be fairly knowledgeable about golf history had no recollection or no understanding of this tournament and of what had happened. And so I thought, and that might be worth pursuing, and that's what led to the book. And I really just had a blast doing the research because it was so much of it was new to
me. Mm-hmm. Well, the first two rounds of the tournament, as you said, were pretty unusual for a USGA run event. 49 players broke par, but in the third round, the scoring came down, and only 18 players broke par, including Ben, who shot a 69. In the fourth round, he shot a 68, and he wound up winning the Hail America by 3 strokes. Was he pretty consistent over those 4 days, and were there really any other players out there who could have challenged him? Did anybody ever really stage a rally and threaten Hogan?
Oh, for sure. So, as I mentioned earlier, even after the 62, he was not in the lead. And after 3 rounds, he was tied for the lead with Mike Terneza, who had opened with the 60. I think he shot 65, 66 his first 2 days, which is unheard of in a U.S. Open. But the final day, and I mentioned him earlier, Jimmy DeMeritt came. I think he was behind by 2 or 3 shots heading into the last round. It was 2 shots because he birdied the first 2 holes, and so he tied the leaders. And back then they staggered tee times. It wasn't like, it's not like it is now where the leaders go off last and the best, and the next best go off after that. They staggered them. They staggered the group so the galleries could, you know, see everybody. And so Demerit went off before Hogan, and Hogan went off before Trinezza, and Byron Nelson was the last one in. And so Demerit actually got to the point on the back nine where he had a 3-shot lead on the field. He had eagled the 13th hole, an eagle two. He knocked in a wedge shot, I believe it was, and then he birdied the next hole. So he was in great shape. And then he had 3 consecutive bogeys. And while he was making those bogeys, Hogan was picking up birdies on 2 holes. It was basically a 5-shot swing. And that was the end for Demerit. The writers at the time said that, yes, Hogan won it, but Demerit kind of, you know, deserves credit for giving it to him because he was in great shape after I won 14 holes on Sunday, but he just couldn't close it. So, yes, to answer your question, Jimmy Demerit really had the tournament in his grip and lost it. And Hogan, you know, Hogan took advantage of it, as Hogan did. He played very steady golf. He, like you said, he shot 68 and ended up winning by, you know, a comfortable margin.
Okay, now the fun starts. At this point in his career, 1942, Ben Hogan had not won an official major. What we call major tournaments, the Masters, the U.S. Open, the Open Championship, and the PGA Championship. And the we wouldn't see Hogan win a major until I believe it was 1946 when he won the PGA. So where did the term major championship come from, and when did it really become a thing?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's something that the PGA and the USGA, they need to take like 5 really, really smart golf people and put them in a room and say, you got to do these majors. You got to do these majors differently than we do them now. I mean, you can't be giving, you can't be holding back British Opens from Ben Hogan and those guys, because they never played in those, in that tournament. I mean, Hogan went over once.
And he won it that year.
And he won, right?
And that's the crazy thing about this, Peter, is 1953, he wins the Masters. He wins the U.S. Open, and he wins the Open Championship. He couldn't, it was actually physically impossible to play in the PGA, let alone win it, right? It was impossible because the end of the PGA overlapped with the beginning of the Open Championship, the British Open. So you couldn't be in two places on opposite sides of the world at the same time. So this whole thing about majors and being able to win all 4 in 1 year was virtually impossible. When did the term major come around?
The popular theory is, I mean, just to digress for a second, like Bobby Jones won 4 majors, but then back then the majors were the U.S. Open, the British Open, the U.S. Amateur, and the British Amateur. Those were the 4 major tournaments. The Masters had yet to, had yet to be born, and the PGA was a tournament that was open only to professionals. So I don't know. That's how they determined the majors back then. I don't know why the PGA wasn't a major and the British Amateur was, for instance. I don't understand that. But that's when Bobby Jones won the Grand Slam in 1930. Those were the tournaments that he won. And then, the popular belief is that the current 4 tournament major thing came into being in 1960 when Palmer won the Masters, and then he followed that up with a win at the U.S. Open, and they kind of created this thing. He and a sports writer from Pittsburgh and Mark McCormick, his kind of guru, you know, agent, said, well, if, you know, because we're in the Producer Open, that's, you know, that's three, and then PGA would be four, we were at Grand Slam. Not many people talked about the Grand Slam until then, and since then, of course, it's that's sort of been chiseled into our golf brains. But back when those guys played, they considered the Western Open to be, I'm not sure if they even used the term major back then, but they met the Western Open was considered to be a major tournament. The North and South was considered to be a major tournament. The British Open was not considered to be a major tournament because nobody went to it because it you'd have to take a boat over and you'd have to take a boat back and you have to qualify. And so you're losing 3 weeks of income for, you know, not a lot of money, and why bother? So it's not fair to those guys to hold them up to the same major qualifications that we're holding the guys up to now, because really the British Open was you know, it might have been a bucket list thing, but it was not a regular thing. And as you noted earlier, at times it even conflicted with the PGA schedule-wise. There wasn't any coordination that at that point between the PGA and the RNA in terms of, like, well, let's make sure the British Open is played in a week where there are no PGA tournaments. So, you know, because you couldn't do it in a week back then. You had to get over and you had to get back and you had to qualify back then. So it was a non-starter for a lot of guys. And Bobby Jones went over there mostly when the Walker Cup was played so that the USGA would pay his way. He's no dummy.
Peter, as I went through all these different points in your book, you know, is as far as how a U.S. Open is played and the differences, if there were differences between a U.S. Open and the Hail America Open.
Oh, yes, for sure.
You know, your book, The Open Question, you know, covers some of that. What about the format of the Hail versus the U.S. Open? Was there a difference? Tell us about the difference in format and how it was played.
There were a number of differences. The first being that it was a 4-day tournament and not a 3-day tournament. The USGA back then held the Open in 3 days with 36 holes on Saturday. And that was kind of their Darwinian, you know, test to the U.S. Open, you know, survival. You know, if you can do this, you know, you can win it and, you know, you can be a tough guy and all that stuff. And then, of course, if it was tied, early on, they'd have like these 36 hole playoffs after it was tied. I mean, it was ridiculous. But the Hail America was conducted in over 4 days as a regular PGA tournament is today. So that was a difference. There was no cut, which was a difference. I don't think that's a big deal, but what they wanted to do was they wanted to raise as much money as they could, which is why they went to 4 days, because you'd have four separate gates. So you'd raise more money if you had four gates rather than three gates. And if you happen to have someone like Bobby Jones, who wasn't in contention but was still playing, he would be a draw. Who might not have made the cut, he would still be playing on the weekend, and that was great. And as a matter of fact, Jones played with Hogan both Saturday and Sunday, even though they were nowhere near each other in the on the score list. Hogan was up near the lead and Jones was not, but they played together, and that, you know, that's going to get people to watch it and people to pay to come and so forth and so on. So those were the two major differences in terms of format. They had some things, long driving contests and putting contests and stuff like that, an aside, but, you know, that I don't think that was a major distraction to the tournament. I mean, the tournament, actually, when you look at it now and you see how it was played, and the cream rose to the top at the end of the day. And I think I point out in the book that when you mentioned the third round, how tough it was, I mean, I think there were more rounds in the 80s that day than there were in the 60s. And by the end of four rounds, you had fewer players under par than were under par at Erin Hills or at Pebble Beach a couple of years ago when Gary Woodland won. So, you know, eventually the good players got to the where the good players do. The bad players ended up where they did, and it produced a worthy champion, and that's obviously an issue, because if, you know, if Jim Trinizza had won it, or even Jimmy Demerit, I don't know if there'd be a groundswell to give Hogan a fifth.
Well, yeah, you know, I have a question lined up for that, and but before I get to that question, you sort of touched upon this. Of course, your book, The Open Question, was or should the Hail America National Open be considered a major because it took the place of the U.S. Open that year, 1942. And without a doubt, Ridgemore certainly played easier than just about any U.S. Open course, especially up to that point in time. But since then, and again, you sort of alluded to this, there have been a few U.S. Opens where scoring went pretty darn low. So should that be factored in? Why or why not?
Well, I think it should. I mean, and not only is it the scoring, is that you've had U.S. Opens at courses where, you know, to be charitable, the conditions were not great. I mean, the gold standard for that is Hazeltine in 1970. It was a basic cow pasture, and the players hated it and bitched about it and said all kinds of nasty things about it. But they held the tournament there, and Tony Jacklin won it, and no one's disputing him his championship. But the course itself was just absolutely hammered by the pros. And I remember watching just a few years ago when Jordan Spieth won at Chambers Bay. I looked at that course and, you know, the guys couldn't putt on the greens for one thing. They were like crazy bad. And I always look at these, when I watch a U.S. Open, I think, God, I'd love to play that course sometime. I never had that feeling about Chambers Bay. It just, it did nothing for me, but there was a lot of criticism about the greens. So the idea that the conditions weren't great and it wasn't set up, those are all valid, but not every year do they play at, you know, Oakmont or Oakland Hills or wherever. So there have been times when the courses have not been so great, and the scoring was ridiculously low for the time. But as I note in the book, you know, Hogan's 62 would still stand, but I think his 271, I think, was eclipsed by McIlroy. At Congressional. So, I mean, I just think there's the scoring part of it. I don't think that's an issue. They play, everybody plays the same course, and, you know, you see what happens at the end of four rounds.
Yep, absolutely. It's like, you know, in baseball, you know, well, look, you haven't played anybody. You play who's on the schedule, and ultimately every team comes around and plays the same schedule, right? And these players all played the same golf course, and it just turns out that Ben Hogan won it. So what about the players themselves years later, or even at that time, what did they have to say about it being or not being a major? What did they think?
I don't think very few of them, you know, considered the Hail America to be a de facto substitute for the U.S. Open. That came along a little bit later, and I think Hogan had a part in doing that. But at the time, it was the newspaper writers at the time were calling it a major and Hogan's first, you know, national triumph and stuff like that. So there was some of that, but I don't think anybody really considered it a de facto U.S. Open. What happened was that I think Hogan his supporters in the media and outside the media, I mean, he talked about getting the medal from the USGA president.
Joe Day. Right.
And and it looked like it looked like the other four that he would eventually win. Wasn't identical, but it was pretty close. So I think that just one thing led to another. And if people look back on the tournament and they see the USGA's fingerprints are all over it. One thing we didn't mention was that they also, on the scene, ruled Sam Bird's clubs to be non-conforming. Now, that wouldn't have happened at the Portland Open or at the, you know, Tallahassee Open or even at the PGA, but it happened here because the USGA was running the tournament. So Sam Bird had to go out and you know, borrow a set of clubs from one of the members and play. And he played pretty well because he was a good golfer. But that just shows that the USGA was involved in this tournament.
Yep. Yep.
Like they would be in a US Open. So I think you can make a case either way. My feeling when people ask me about this is that the only decision that matters is the decision of the USGA. And they have determined that it's not going to be recognized as a U.S. Open. So we have to live with that. But I also say, well, Hogan thought it was. And, you know, I'm at the end of the day, that's a pretty strong affirmation in my mind. I mean, if he thought it should have counted, I mean, I think you have to give weight to that.
Right, too. Especially later in life, he considered it a major.
Yes.
So so touch a little bit more upon the medal that he was given for winning and what Joe Day, the USGA president, had to say about it being a major.
He was given the medal. They had cast the medal already for the 42 Open, you know, thinking that they would give it to the 42 Open champion at Interlochen. And when that didn't happen, they kept the medal, but they just changed the writing on the back of the medal to say that it was the Hail America, not a U.S. Open. But if you look at the front of it, it's pretty much the same as the other ones that Hogan would eventually win. It's not identical, but it's, you have to be pretty sharp-eyed to pick out the difference. So when he was always asked about it, and this is funny when you read about Hogan and how he was asked about this, the medals were a huge part of it for him. He would always say, well, I've got five medals that look the same. So that tells me I've won five U.S. Opens. And he was also a little bit bitter that the 42 Masters winner was acknowledged as a major champion. He lost in a playoff that year to Byron Nelson, so he was doubly bitter about that. He was in the PGA champion. Sam Steed was recognized that year as well. So why not the U.S. Open? That's what he's thinking. I mean, I won a tournament. It was staged like a U.S. Open. It had qualifying rounds, it had second round qualifying rounds. They ran it like a U.S. Open, but it's not a U.S. Open. So,
and what about Joe Day?
Well, Joe Dye,
I'm sorry.
I think that's how we pronounce it. It might be Day, but I think it's Dye. He is, you know, obviously he's not around anymore, but he was quoted many times as saying he would have loved to have given this championship to Ben Hogan, but he just didn't think that it merited a U.S. Open, and he went back to the course. He said the course was just not U.S. Open standard. We didn't have a chance to get it toughened up. You know, the U.S. Open is famous for what? Fast greens, slim fairways, and heavy rough. And Ridgemore did not really have any of those. So he falls back on the course wasn't in U.S. Open shape, and we can't do it. But you know, that's one of the arguments we just went over with, you know, Hazeltine and Aaron Hills and Chambers Bay, that, you know, the courses are not always in great shape for the U.S. Mm-hmm. Open. And this one, you know, Ridgemore gets a bad rap. I mean, they stepped up at a time when nobody else did, and they said, we'll do it, we'll run it. And they staged a good tournament. There was the players themselves had no complaints about the course and the course conditions. You know, maybe because they played well, but there weren't any complaints about the course.
Well, Sports Forgotten Heroes is a podcast about, you know, forgotten teams, forgotten players, guys who played second fiddle, who probably had, you know, they were overshadowed by Babe Ruth and Jim Brown, and but still had a Hall of Fame career. They weren't as flamboyant. Maybe their name wasn't in the news as much. And this tournament sort of qualifies in that kind of light. And here's where the argument of is it a major or is it not a major gets really foggy for me. Obviously, I have to do a lot of research to prepare for my podcast. And gosh darn it, Pete, it is not easy to find a whole lot of information about the Hail America National Open. It isn't even easy to find a leaderboard for this tournament. Why? Why is the USGA so secretive about the Hail America? It's almost as if it's hiding something.
Well, it's really been, you know, erased from their archives. I mean, if you go visit their museum in Far Hills, New Jersey, and they list the Open winners, they're the years 42, 43, 44, and 45 are blank. There's nothing there. They do have a display up on the Hail America tournament there, but it's not in any way suggesting that it was the U.S. Open. It's more to commemorate their support of the war effort in the 40s. So I just don't think that the USGA ever considered it to be anything more than just a substitute for the U.S. Open, not a, you know, a replacement or whatever. And but I don't, on the second hand, I don't know why they don't have any kind of references to it in their, you know, record books as you know, as a tournament that they sponsored and ran in 1942. I think it would help if they just kind of acknowledged that and said, yeah, well, we did have this tournament that we ran in 1942. We don't think it's a U.S. Open, but here's what happened. And let, you know, and then let the reader decide.
But,
which is what I try to do.
But, and here's another part that makes it really foggy for me is when we talk about the U.S. Open, we talk about it being our national open. And what's this called? The Hail America National Open.
National
so
open.
Why, you know, yep. They should have changed the name at least.
Right. No, I think they should have something on it. In every kind of U.S. Open publication, they should note that this tournament was held, and they could spin it in a positive way in terms of how much money they raised for the war effort and what they did to support the war effort. And Ben Hogan won, but we don't consider it a U.S. Open because, you know, the course wasn't ready and, you know, blah, blah, blah. But it is kind of amazing because I mean, the people that are in the USGA library and the archivists there, they know all about the tournament, and they were very helpful to me. And they did nothing to stand in my way because they knew what I was writing, and I was sort of challenging them to say, like, why aren't you considering this U.S. Open? Here are the reasons why you didn't. Well, I'm going to say those reasons don't hold up anymore. But, you know, in the end of the day, they're the ones that make the decision. Mm-hmm. So what you and I think and what anybody else thinks really doesn't matter. It's what they think, and they are, you know, they're not going to change their mind on that.
Well, look, I mean, Hogan won it. He got the medal. He considers it a major. He says it's a fifth U.S. Open. But here is the argument against it. Had a guy like Otis Chrisman, a journeyman pro who actually contended, won this tournament, had anyone besides Hogan won this tournament, would we be having this conversation? Can that play a factor into all of this?
We would not. We would not. You would not have my number, and I would not be talking to you. No, that is absolutely true. And I think this only happened after the fact, and I think Hogan was responsible in a lot of ways for bringing this to light by talking about when he was playing in, I think it was Oakmont, one of the Opens, after he'd won a couple, they asked him, you know, something, and he said, well, I'm shooting for my fourth. Anyway, he was really shooting for his third. And then, well, what are you talking about? Well, you know, I won this tournament in 42, blah, blah, blah. And I think that was what really got it going. And then it was picked up by the media. And then people started to say, well, wait a minute, let's look at this tournament. What's he talking about? Why does he think this should count as a U.S. Open? And then they did basically what I did. They went back and looked at the tournament and said, well, wait a minute. Well, the USGA ran it like a U.S. Open. They invited all the good players. It was it wasn't a great U.S. Open venue, but it was a legitimate tournament. And yeah, there were a few changes, but the U.S. Open has changed over the years. It's morphed into now a 4-day tournament. It wasn't a 4-day tournament in 1962. Mm-hmm. I went to the 1963 U.S. Open playoff, and it was just the only reason I could go was it was on a Sunday. Because mm-hmm. the 36-hole final on Saturday at the end of the tie. Mm-hmm. So it's changed over the years in terms of, rounds and stuff like that. So, and playoffs. Now it's a 4-hole playoff. It used to be 18 holes. It used to be 36 holes. So it's changed a lot. And so I think that's what happened was that he said, well, wait a minute. I won this tournament in 1942. Go back and take a look at it. I think it should count as a U.S. Open. And that's what people did.
Well, Peter, your book, The Open Question, Ben Hogan and Golf's Most Enduring Controversy, is certainly a great, great account of a tournament that will, I guess, live in infamy and leaves everyone to guess on their own, should it or should it not be a major? I really enjoyed reading the book. I really enjoyed talking to you before about Lloyd Mangrum, today about the Open Question. And I want to thank you so much for spending some time with me on Sports Forgotten Heroes.
Well, it has been my pleasure because I love talking about this subject. And as I said earlier, I had a blast doing this book because there was so much stuff that I learned and going back and looking, and it had to be a fun time to be a golf pro.
Sure.
Back then, if you didn't care about money.
Absolutely. Again, Peter, thank you so much for joining me on Sports Forgotten Heroes.
You're very welcome, Morgan. Thank you, Morgan. Thank you for having me.
You got it. How do you answer the question? Should Ben Hogan be credited with a fifth U.S. Open championship? There are several questions like this throughout sports and sports history. I don't know if you can answer it. It's what makes sports so great. The debates, barroom discussions, books, articles, blogs, and podcasts like this kind of stuff to ponder. My head scratcher again is this. If you're going to put on a tournament and you change the name and venue, does that disqualify it from what it was originally intended to be? I guess it's a question for debate and one that we will be asking for years and years to come. In the meantime, thank you again to my guest, Peter May, for joining me on Sports Forgotten Heroes to talk about the Hail America National Open and the mysteries surrounding it. Peter sure knows his stuff, and I thought we had a great conversation about the Hail America National Open. Of course, the question remains, should then Hogan be credited with 5 U.S. Open championships. Guess that's a question only the USGA will ever be able to answer. Hey, thanks to all of you for listening, and I'll see you next time on Sports Forgotten Heroes.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians. You'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcast. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.